Lots of questions, but we don't guarantee to answer them all. So we'll see what's in the basket. For those of you who don't know, this is Aya Satima, who's visiting us for America. And she was one of the witnessing bhikkhunis at our bhikkhuni ordination. This one is easy. Why do the nuns all walk as a group to the meditation hall? Is it not allowed to walk as an individual? So, Satima, would you like to answer that one? It is allowed to walk as an individual, but it's nice for us as a group, so because we're so rarely together, to look after each other and to walk as a group. And also, part of the bhikkhuni rules require that we have a companion when in situations where we are likely to be meeting males. So generally we are just aware of that as one of our rules, and so we protect each other by doing things as a group. If I am nothing, an illusion, then what is or who is reborn? The answer to this question is in the question itself. If I am nothing, an illusion, then what is reborn? I am nothing starts off on the wrong premise, because it assumes I am something and I am then nothing. The whole teaching on non-self is pointing to the fact that there isn't an I who's anything permanently existing in our current life. It's only a continuum that is existing at this moment in this life. And so this continuum that's a process of cause and effect, one condition after the other, supporting life while this body is intact and leading to the end of this life when the body is no longer intact, the process then continues with just the mental continuum, what we call the mind, which is the feeling, the perception, the sankhara, and the consciousness. The consciousness continues into the next birth, and it's that process that is reborn. So there is no I as I am now that's reborn. It is simply this process that continues. You can write them again to Achan Bam tomorrow if you want to get another answer. Someone told me that jhana means the same as Zen. Is this true? Now, Aya Satima was previously a Zen priest, so you can answer that one.
The word Zen actually is the word for dharana in Chinese, and it means jhana. That is all that is Zen. It doesn't mean Zen. then don't offer jhana at all. Yeah, practice is so different, a little different to our practice. They don't go into jhanas, they don't talk about jhanas. But the word Zen, derived from the Chinese word for jhana, that is how it came. So that is why the Zen and the jhana is supposed to be the same, but they don't even, they didn't even know the meaning of what it is jhana when I asked, are you getting to jhanas? No, they don't. So that is what I know about the Zen and the jhana.
If one as a lay person has difficulty and struggles to achieve right concentration by not entering jhana, then would this goal be less difficult if they were to renounce possessions and home life to become a monk or nun? Thank you. I think it's a very rare person who doesn't have difficulty and struggle to achieve right concentration. And to achieve jhana is not an easy thing. So I don't think that you should be disappointed or discouraged. It's Ajahn Brahm makes it sound very easy, and that's part of his sales pitch. But I think that sometimes we here in Perth don't realise that Ajahn Brahm is really an extraordinary monk and an extraordinary meditator. And we judge ourselves, or we judge all other teachers by his standard, and think that everyone is at his standard. But he is really quite extraordinary. So one of the reasons why we enter the homeless life is to free ourselves of the obstacles to achieving these deeper states of meditation. But there is no guarantee that just because you leave home and become a monastic that you will be any closer to achieving right concentration, because it's the freedom of the mind that is really important. And that doesn't happen just because you change your clothes. Certainly that's a big support, and the support of the monastic life, the simplicity and the repetition and the guidelines by which we live by all help to simplify our life and to allow us to simplify our mind. But also we bring our own karmic inheritance with us, and our karmic inheritance may be more or less favourable towards achieving deep states of concentration. Even in the home life, we may have a karmic inheritance that allows us to, because of our virtue and our love and our generosity and our general goodness, to achieve very deep states of meditation, because of our goodness as a lay person, keeping the five precepts purely, and all the good qualities that we develop. Whereas we may enter monastic life and not have such a rich karmic inheritance. We have the karmic inheritance for renunciation. We have the karmic inheritance for determination and other things. But we haven't got sufficient of the heart qualities yet developed to immediately or quickly develop in meditation. So while it's a help to enter the monastic life, it's more important to build up the causes and conditions that lead to fruitful meditation or life as a lay person or in the monastic life. At the monks' monastery, women are welcome. Women can stay for up to 2 weeks. Why is this not possible at the nuns' monastery? Many women are unhappy they cannot stay at the nuns' monastery. Largely, it's a consequence of our not having accommodation that is available for people to come and stay. We do actually have short-term lay guests coming to stay with us. We have them out of the Rains Retreat. In the Rains Retreat, people come to stay for the whole Rains Retreat, but we usually have lay people staying with us. They stay in the nun's cottage, and some people find it very suitable, but some people find that's too busy, because this is our main activity area, the nun's cottage. So if you want to stay at the nun's monastery, then you need to contact us, and we have a form which you have to fill in, and then you tell us when you would like to come, and we'll try to arrange a stay. And usually for people who are coming for the first time, we ask them to come for up to a week, usually 3 days. Because they are in the main area where there is a lot of busyness and a lot of things going on in that area, we like to know the people if they're going to stay longer. So we ask first that you stay for a few days. We get to know you, you get to know us. And then you're welcome to stay longer. The difference is at the nuns' monastery that the visitors are required to follow the schedule of the monastery. They're much more involved in what's going on at the monastery than at the monks' monastery. And some people prefer to go to the monks' monastery because they don't have to be involved in the routine of the monastery, whereas if you come to the nuns' monastery, you need to be prepared to be involved in the routine there. This is a joke. A woman is walking alongside a river trying to find a place to cross. She sees someone on the other side and calls out, "How do I get to the other side?" "You are on the other side," comes the reply. A couple of days ago, I asked a question on intention. This is the follow-up to that. If a person commits a verbal or physical act without intention to do so, and that act was harmful to another being or beings, does that mean the person who carried out that act is not going to get any vipaka? Please clarify. Thanks and metta. So karma making is intention, and if there is no intention there to cause harm, then that is not the karmic vipaka that you receive for that action. But you may have been creating the karma of being mindless, of acting with confusion, of not paying attention, something that you constantly are doing, and thoughtlessly you hurt something, not that you mean to hurt it, but you know that you have not been paying attention, walking or whatever you're doing, just doing it mindlessly. And so that may be the karma vipaka, that habit pattern, if you like, that you are reinforcing. So that habit pattern is reinforced, and that is a habit pattern which comes up more easily next time or in the same situation. And so that is the vipaka that you're receiving. If you are doing it without an intention to harm, but doing it mindlessly, that is the habit pattern that you are reinforcing. Whether you call that a karma vipaka or not, it's not a punishment. Sometimes we misunderstand that a karma vipaka is like the punishment of it. But if you think in terms of these are habit patterns reinforced over and over again, it's not that something outside yourself or ourselves is giving us the fruit of our action. We are creating a consequence for ourselves just by repeating the same sort of behaviour over and over again. I think this is the same writing. I read in the book that feelings that we experience are our karma vipakas. Is this correct? Yes, it is. Is it because feelings we experience are a result of our defilements or our goodness? Lobha dosa moha versus alobha adosa omoha, clashing with an object. Meaning, if an object meets with the defilement, then a negative feeling arises, and if an object meets with a positive quality, a positive feeling arises. Please explain metta. So the feelings that we're talking about are the pleasant, unpleasant or neutral experience that goes along with every sense contact. So this is called the Vedana, in the way that the Buddha explains the mind. And if we have a pleasant experience with an object, then the next time we have a similar object or a similar experience, we experience those feelings again, because the present is conditioned by what we have experienced in the past. So the pleasant feelings that we experienced in the past come up with the object in the present. The object in the present may not be exactly the same object, but it's a similar object. And that Vedana arises without our consciously wishing it. The Vedana arises depending on our past conditioning. In the moment, if we're mindful, we can notice that there is a pleasant or an unpleasant or a neutral feeling arising in response to the object that we are now coming in contact with. It's not the inherent nature of the object. It is our experience of the object. And this is where we have the opportunity, when we're sufficiently mindful, to not react with aversion, liking, or liking towards the feeling that arises in the present moment. Our normal reaction is to like the feelings that are pleasant and to not like the feelings that are unpleasant and to think it's the object's fault. But actually, the feelings are arising within us in relation to the object. They're not in the object themselves. So we have the opportunity to become equanimous to the feeling so we don't get a strong reaction to having positive feelings come up, or we don't have a strong reaction to having negative feelings come up. But we have to be mindful in order to be aware. It's not the object. The feelings are arising in us as a result of our conditioning. And we don't have to like or dislike the object. The object is, if you like, you could say neutral in terms of just being that object. It's our relationship to it, where we have the opportunity to change that relationship by a different reaction to it in the present moment. A different reaction to our reaction to the object, if you know what I mean. Thank you. This is addressed to you.
Can you please tell us about your monastery? What is the difference between the Buddhist and the What is the support?
See, we don't have a big monastery like this in the U.S. where I live. I'm the only bhikkhuni there. And we have even the temple, the monks' monastery is very small compared to what is here. And we have only two monks living there. So it's not, I can't stay in the monks' monastery. So I stayed by myself in a kuti, quite away from the monks' monastery. And the support is not as good as here. I always say when I go back, wow, you have to go to Australia and see the support there. There's very good support. No, our support is much less than there. But when it comes to practice, it doesn't matter where you are. The practice is the same wherever you are. No matter where you go or where you are, that is where you are. And the practice is exactly the same. There's no difference in the practice. You can practice anywhere and it's the same. When you ask the practice, when I'm talking of the practice, I mean my own internal practice. It's the same. But, we don't have if I have 10 people coming to the temple on a given day, we think, wow, we have a lot of people today. So that is how it is. I mean, I don't think other than for a big day like a Vesak celebration, then we'll have about I still don't think we'll have this many people, even for a Vesak celebration. And that's about the maximum. That's a big group that we have come. So the support is much less, and the other things are not as good as here. But I think we can practice anywhere, so that there's no difference in the practice. Yes, I like coming here. I like coming to the because I think I'm Ajahn Brahm fan. So after I saw him when I was visiting Sri Lanka for the first time. That was in 2005. And then I thought, wow, this is the one I want for my teacher. But unfortunately, I'm a woman, so I can't be in the monastery. So I do the next best thing. I come once a year and stay for a month or two and go. So that's the next best thing. So I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to see all the support that the bhikkhunis get here. And I'm happy that I was a part of that for about 6 weeks now. And so that's all I can say about it. If there's anything more, if you have want anything more, if there's any questions, I can answer. But other than that, that's about all I can say. That is, pardon?
Bhikkhuni Gunasari?
Yes, I know Bhikkhuni Gunasari. But she also lives by herself.
Yes.
Yeah, she lives by herself.
Yeah, she didn't have that much support.
No, because we are all scattered.
Yeah.
See, the few bhikkhunis that are in the United States are scattered all over. So there's no place that has got two bhikkhunis living together. So once in a way, even there, once in a way, we do get together and try to do something together. Other than that, no. But I guess we have to start somewhere. And it takes a lot of... it is difficult to be alone and to practice alone. And you here, you are very, very fortunate that you have a whole Bhikkhu Sangha, Bhikkhuni Sangha here. So you are very fortunate to have a Bhikkhuni Sangha who's very practicing very well and who's very well disciplined. So this, I learned a lot by being with the Bhikkhuni Sangha for 1.5 months, and I enjoyed being there. When I go back again, I'll be all by myself. But I'm a hermit bhikkhuni. Okay, that's all. Thank you. Oh, yes? Yes, that's the color of the monastery where I got ordained in Sri Lanka. So I had to wear the same color, and this is the color that the monks that's in Minnesota wear. So I had to use the same color. And as I think I like the color because it makes me feel happy. As Ajahn Brahm says, a happy color. And I'm a happy person, so it's okay. Huh? That's right. Yeah. And I thought I'd give a little bit of color sitting here too with other bhikkhunis. Okay, thank you.
I just read out the question, so not a question. It says, "Dear Ajahn Vayama, isn't it living a brahmacharya life solves lots of problems? If someone is getting that chance, how lucky they are. Please comment on this. When I see four of you nuns walking in line, I feel so happy. Thank you. Want to say something? thank you for feeling so happy. I don't think living a celibate life solves lots of problems. You bring your problems with you wherever you go. Just like Ajahn Vajrayana says, don't just change your robes because I'm still the same person. If someone's getting... Yes, but I do feel very lucky to have the opportunity to be a nun because it has... Ajahn Vajrayana did explain earlier that you have the schedule and the form of monastic lives and the precepts which allowed me to work with my crazy mind or my defilements. So the fact that because of the form and the practice, it's more simple lifestyle than to give me more time and space and with meditation to see my crazy mind or nutty mind, however you say it, and the defilements or emotions and feelings, then give me a chance to work with it because I don't have the distractions of televisions or parties or going out anywhere else except I just have this crazy mind to look at. So for that is very lucky. It do take time to work with it. Sometimes it's very tough because you get bored. You feel it 9 days, how it feels like. I've been in the monastery for 7.5 years, continuous. So can't go home, no television. Just like Ajahn Brahm says too, can't choose what I eat. Sometimes there's a defilement too. But I do feel very fortunate and lucky. That it's beneficial. It's hard work, but it's very beneficial so far. That's why I'm still here. Thank you. Unless you have more questions, you can ask. Or any other vulnerables or some other to add in? Vulnerables, but yeah, do you want to say something? No comments.
Does the karmic forces of past births play a part in our meditation? The karmic forces of past births do play a part in our meditation. This is what I meant by the karmic inheritance that we all bring with us. We've had many lifetimes before. We've made lots of good karma to be born as a human being, and especially in the circumstances that we have here in Perth. So we have a lot of supporting conditions for our meditation, but we also have a karmic inheritance that includes unwholesomeness, unwholesome deeds that we've done in countless lives, and those energies or tendencies, they are also liable to fruit at any time, to come up to the surface of the mind, to drive our speech, our actions, as well as our thoughts. And when we are living each moment, we're making new karma, so that is also added into the mixture. So it's not only what we have brought with us, but what we are doing with it when it arises in the moment, and what we are doing with new situations. So we're always making new karma also, and that is affecting our meditation. So this is where we have this wonderful opportunity by being mindful and developing our ability to be still, with to refrain and restrain whatever comes up, whether it is from this life, whether it's from just the previous moment, or whether it seems to come from nowhere, but comes from karma that we've made in a previous birth. We have the opportunity to make new wholesome karma right this moment. We only have that opportunity if we are mindful and restrained, and we don't just act impulsively according to our habits, but we have enough wisdom to choose a more skillful reaction in the present moment. When we're in our meditation, we are also making karma, how we deal with what comes up in our meditation. If we indulge in all memories or get lost in fantasies of the future, then we're reinforcing the tendency to do just that sort of thing, and that carries over into our daily life too. We don't stay present for very long. We're doing one thing and off somewhere else in our mind. Our mind isn't with our body in the in our daily life. So we reinforce that habit, reinforce that as a pattern, and then when we come to meditation, that is the habit patterns that come out in the meditation. So if we see that there is a continuum between our daily life activities and our meditation, we won't think that we can do one thing in meditation and another thing in our daily life. We'll realise that it's one whole. And so the karma that we make in our life will support our meditation if it's with mindfulness and with wisdom. And the meditation karma that we make with mindfulness and wisdom in our day, in our meditation, will help us to act more skillfully in our daily life. And that will support us in gradually waking up, purifying our mind, both in our daily life and in our meditation. Oh. If it is not too personal, could you please tell us about your paths to becoming nuns? Also, could you talk a bit about the tradition, bhikkhuni tradition? So we were thinking that everyone has heard our personal histories before, so there would be limited interest in that, but perhaps we'll start with Venerable Hasapanya.
I remember last year we were being asked the same questions, and then I was thinking, shall I, you know, just record it, you know, whenever, you know, this is always the same questions people ask you, your history, why you become a nun, and I think I should record it and then just press the button and then And I really like last year what Aya Satima said, you know, when someone asked her the past, she says, I already buried my past. That is a really good answer. But actually, before I become a nun, I'm just like everybody else, you know. Like most of the women, very attached to the appearance, you know, putting on a new polish, you know. And then I really hate doing housework because that, you know, my new, my polish will come out, you know. And then, you know, but I ended up in a monastery. And I remember when I decided to become a nun, and my family said that, oh, that they said that, you know, you have lots of defilements, you know. You can become a nun. And then I told them, if I have no defilements, so I don't have to become a nun then. I don't have to practice. So, but, and actually what brings me to become a nun, a monastic, actually is started off with meditation. When I was a lay person, when I started to meditate, and, you know, before that I haven't experienced any, I mean, inner peace, you know, you haven't tasted it before. So then the only options that I know that in life that is, you know, beautifying myself and going to eat good food, you know, try all this what most of the people do in the world. So I try very hard to find really true happiness in the world, but it's still not really satisfying and fulfilling. And actually it's really changed my whole life when I started to meditate, because when I first started to meditate, I really, that the first time I experienced the inner peace and happiness, and I never meditate before. The first time I meditate, and I sat for an hour, and I feel so peaceful and so nice. I said, wow, it's really nice. And that's really changed my whole life. This is how, like, before that I had, because all I know is just the five senses. But after I have experienced that, then I know there is another type of happiness. So then I spend more times in meditations, and I quite, and then later I spend more times in the monastery, staying in the monastery, and practicing in Thailand, and then spend some time with some Meiji and some forest monastery, and I really enjoy and love the lifestyle. I must say, I really love it. Before I become a nun, I have no great idea that become a nun to enlighten other people, to save other people. So to me, it's just very simple. I just like the lifestyle. So, and I enjoy the lifestyle. So then this is why I choose to become a nun. And that's all.
I can't run away. That's one of the disadvantages of becoming a nun, since you can't run away. Sitting here must answer questions. Personal path to become a nun. I must say, being introduced to, I'm actually from Perth, those that who do not know. Someone sitting in this hall actually introduced me to Dhammaloka and BSWA. And I went on pilgrimage with Ajahn Varma and Ajahn Brahm by 2000, I think the year 2000. And that's how I become a sort of a Theravada Buddhist. I used to be a Mahayana, practice in the Mahayana tradition. And I'm like those of you who are from BSWA, I'm a regular of Dhammaloka, sitting at the back of the hall. And like it's more than 10 years ago, and now I got to sit at the front of the hall. So beware if you're sitting at the back of the hall at Dharmaloka. You might get a chance, or very likely to see at the front. And I'm fortunate that I met Ajahn Varma and Ajahn Brahm. And Ajahn Varma is the first teacher, a female nun that I met in Theravada traditions, and Ajahn Brahm is the first Theravada monk that I met, so I find that they're very inspiring, so I decided to give it a go to try Dharmasara since I'm from Perth, so I don't have any much obstacles, just trying out, and find that is very beneficial, so I stay on. Thanks. Any thanks, any questions?
It's quite a while since I became a nun, so it's I find it's very interesting actually what the mind does over time. I've been a nun for about 25 years, and so during that time, I've reconsidered the reasons why I ordained in the first instance. Not just reconsidered them intellectually, but as I have become more familiar with my mind and seen my own life history in a different perspective and become more aware of the process that makes up every individual, I can see different forces at play which I couldn't see at the time. As Ajahn Ram has been saying lately, there's no choice to the matter. You think that you're making a choice, but in fact the causes and conditions are fruiting. So my initial reasons that I became a nun was because Buddhism gave the best answers to the questions that I had. And originally I didn't intend to be a nun for this long. I was really just trying it out, but I found that the lifestyle and the happiness that came from being a nun was the best happiness that I experienced, as well as the clearest answers to the questions in my life.
See, why I became a nun is a very difficult answer to give, because I myself don't know why. I think I brought it from my past, last birth, because nothing in this life was conducive to by becoming a nun. I'm originally from Sri Lanka. And other than the fact that I was born a Buddhist, I was not a practicing Buddhist. I went to Catholic schools my whole life. And I knew more Catholicism than Buddhism when I was growing up. And unlike the present time, the nuns try their best to convert you. So I was really, and I enjoyed those nuns. Those nuns were wonderful. They were all from overseas. I had a American nun, a British nun, Irish nun. They were the most wonderful people. I think most probably they must have inspired me without my knowledge. And so other than the little that we did, Vesak, I was more like a Vesak Buddhist who went to temple, and just all we did was put some flowers, light some candles, and incense. So that was about the, so there was, it's not the practice that made me. It's only after I came to the United States. I came to United States 35 years ago. That made me think about even Buddhism and started reading about Buddhism. And then somehow or other the thought came that I wanted to become a, see, once my children were all settled, I thought, okay, and maybe I'll try becoming a nun. And of course I got objections from my family, didn't let me become a nun. So then the next best thing was there was a Zen center close by. So I started going to the Zen center. And my first question when I went to the Zen center was, maybe after a couple of weeks I asked the Zen master, can I become a Zen priest? He looked at me and said, I don't even know you. How can I make you a Zen priest? Then I asked, what do I have to do? So he said, at least you have to be practicing for at least 2 years. So anyway, I did that and I became a Zen priest. So, of course, I had to fight with him a lot before I became a Zen priest because he was not trying to, anyway, to make a long, but it was not, there was no satisfaction. I felt it was like I called it a halfway house. Because I was neither here nor there. I mean, I was still running a business. I was a Montessori teacher. I had my own schools. I was still running a business, still going for parties, still doing everything that a normal person did. But I was still a Zen priest, so it didn't make any sense to me. Then in 2004, Ajahn Vayama has much more experience than I, even though I'm sitting ahead of her. This is why I feel very bad. So I'm a very new bhikkhuni. In 2004, I went to Sri Lanka and didn't tell any of my family. I became a samaneri and I called my family and said, I changed the color of my robes. That's all I said. So by this time, they were used to my being a little bit of a monastic. My family, my brother thought I am crazy. He called and asked, have you gone out of your mind? Are you crazy? I said, no, I'm happy. So then 2 years after that, I went back again to Sri Lanka and got ordained as a bhikkhuni. And the day after I got my ordination, I had to come back to America again. So I really, as I said, I don't have a place. But one in 2005, as a samaneri, is when I saw Ajahn Brahm in Sri Lanka. And actually, now I have a hard time after I met Ajahn Brahm, because no other monk is good enough for me. I don't think he even knows that, but to him, he has been my teacher. And so since I saw him in 2005, since then this is my third visit to Australia, just to get the teachings from him. That's all that I... So I really enjoyed coming here, and as I said, my becoming a nun is from the past, nothing from here. And as she said before, last time also I was talking about this. The same question was asked last time when I came in last November for the Ajahn Brahm's retreat, and the same question. But I really don't talk too much about my past because I buried my past and I don't want to pull it out again other than the fact that and the happiest thing that ever happened in my life is to get rid of everything that I had and to have nothing. I absolutely have nothing to own myself. And only thing is still I still have little grandchildren who don't understand and why I have to give up everything. So the 9-year-old, see, I have my apartment, my kuti is above my younger son's garage. So that is, I call it my little vihara, my kuti. So once in a way, my biggest donor, my biggest dana, the one who gives the dana to me is my daughter-in-law. And she's American, but she's good about it. So my little granddaughter asked about what are you doing and all. I said, I'm trying to let go of all the things that I'm attached to. So she said, as a little kid, all she could understand was, but you can't let go of my mother. She's the one who gives you the food. So that is how I said, no, honey, I'm not letting go in that way. I don't want to be attached to anyone. But later on, you will understand what let go means. So actually, not having anything, having nothing now. I have absolutely not even a place to stay to be, other than the little apartment above the garage. I don't even have a place to stay. But I think never in my life have I been so happy. I feel very happy, very light-hearted, and I think anyone who gives up things, every time I gave up something, it was a little happier. And once I gave up all, I was the most happiest person. Now, I consider myself a happy hermit bhikkhuni. Thank you.
The second part of this question was to talk a little bit about the bhikkhuni tradition. And I just, for those of you who aren't aware, the bhikkhuni tradition was started by the Buddha himself when he was alive and teaching. He established the Bhikkhu Sangha, and then he later established the Bhikkhuni Sangha. And he considered that the Bhikkhu Sangha and the Bhikkhuni Sangha were two of the pillars of his dispensation. The other two pillars were the lay men and lay women. These disciples, whether that they were monastics or lay, he considered that his teaching career or his dispensation, or we say his sasana is the Pali word, was fully established when he had monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen, who could understand the teaching, practice the teaching, and pass on the teaching to the best of their ability, whatever they themselves had understood and experienced and benefited from. So the Bhikkhuni Sangha is nothing new. In the time of the Buddha, there were many, many bhikkhunis, and there were many who became fully enlightened. And so the tradition of fully enlightened nuns started from the time of the Buddha and continued in India until the 12th century. And at the same time that Buddhism was taken from India to Sri Lanka, the Bhikkhuni ordination was taken just a few years later. And that was the first time bhikkhunis were existing in were starting this from the time from India out into the world. So first to Sri Lanka, and from Sri Lanka, the ordination was taken later to China, and from China to Korea and Japan and Vietnam and other places. So the bhikkhuni tradition was started by the Buddha and existed for many centuries in India and produced many fully enlightened nuns, not just in India, but throughout the world. And so we hope that eventually there will be enlightened nuns here in Perth too. So the last question is, Ajahn Brahm talked about the non-driverless bus taking us through our pain and pleasure of life. Does that mean the driverless driver is our past karma, which we now having our ups and downs in life? Please comment. Thank you kindly. So as I said earlier, it's not just our past karma, it's the karma that we're making in the present moment. We are constantly making new karma. So what happens to us and what we do with it is a large part of what this life consists of. There are things that come to us unasked and unwanted, and we can't trace where they've come from. We can just assume, if we have faith in the Buddha's teachings and explanation, that this is the fruiting of our past karma. Sometimes we can see where those things have come from, or how we've contributed to their happening in this life itself. And then as we deal with life in the present moment, we are reacting to things that have come to us, and some of those things we like, some of those things we don't like, some of those things we've worked consciously to have happen, some of those things we've tried to avoid. This is all making new karma, and it all is part of the mix that we call our life. Whether we can see where it comes from, whether we like it or we don't like it, whether we are consciously working with it or not, this is all that life contains. What we have the wonderful opportunity of starting to become consciously aware of all these factors, all these ingredients in our life that make up what we call our life, and to work with them. Some of the things we can't change, but some of the things we can change. We can certainly change our reactions to them by understanding them, by purifying the mind so there's less greed or less hatred, less delusion or wrong understanding in the mind. These are the things we can do. So we may not have exactly what we want happening, but we can move it in a certain direction. And that's where we can say that we're driving our life by the choices that we make. But there are always ingredients that we're not aware of, and that's when it becomes the driverless bus, a process that we can't fully know. There are always factors that we don't know that are in the mix of our life. So we've just got to deal with those when they come up. It's not that we choose them or select them, but when they come up, they interact with what's already there, what's coming up next, and that's what we have to deal with. So it really is a process. We can't know the exact ingredients of the process, but we can learn about the underlying principle, and that helps us to understand what we can do something about, what we can't change, and what we can deal with, how we can deal with things more skillfully when they come. So it's not just past karma, it's the karma that we're making now. So that's the last question, and it's 9 o'clock. So, good timing. Thank you for all those questions, and tomorrow Archan Brahma will be back.